Fake to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the 13th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series, where I talk to people from different backgrounds on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. My objective from this podcast is to have learning conversations with a range of people and share those curated insights with you. This time, I'm excited to be talking to Karthik Reddy, managing partner at Bloom Ventures. Karthik has an MBA from IIM Bangalore. He worked in Amex for 3 years after that in Mumbai, and then went to Wharton to pursue his MBA. He subsequently had a range of roles, including banking, tech, strategic planning, and corporate development, before setting up Bloom Ventures around late 2010. In our conversation, we spoke about how he thought about his career at different points, specifically focusing on how he thought about going to Wharton after a degree in IMB. We also spent some time on venture investing as a profession and how it's different from some of the other investing professions like angel investing and private equity investing. We also spent time on what it takes to do well as an investor and his perspectives on transitioning effectively from some of the other adjacent industries like consulting and banking into venture investing. We delve deeper into his perspectives around what differentiates great entrepreneurs from the rest, and he shared his perspectives on how some of these entrepreneurs scaled up as the business grew. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Karthik, thanks for your time. Excited to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you for.
Before we dive in, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and, more importantly, why you do what you do?
So, I think technology has kind of always fascinated me, more by way of personal adoption, education, just being in those markets. So, always wanted to do something around it. And a bunch of circumstances led me to a collection of experiences, both in the US and India, which made me want to be in the midst of all of it and not maybe tied to one idea or two, but arguably hundreds. And, and that's the luxury you have as a venture capitalist. So driven by that, but why do I do this versus, you know, arguably more lucrative jobs or more higher paying jobs relative to my peers? I think it's a tough ride, but it allows me to essentially do two, three things that I love a lot, which is, one is clearly, I think I have a view on where the world is going. So typically a good investor should have that. But you can have it in various forms. You can have a market view and play on small arbitrages in a currency market or a commodities market. Or you can fundamentally see if you want to shape the world. So in some sense, I think there's this, you have to have this notion of a little bit of idealism always tucked away, with, of course, a healthy dose of reality to survive in the world, to actually be a venture capitalist. So I don't think that streak has ever gone away. So I think a lot of my friends and family think I'm foolish to be thinking that way after you turn 40. But it's what I think keeps me motivated to be in this business.
And when you say where the world is going, are you saying this from a technology lens or is it a broader strategic view? Across dimensions?
It has to be across dimensions, I think. I think it's not... Technologies are always arguably a little ahead of their time. Relative to where people's perceptions on how it can change their life for the better are. People are very sort of prone to, you know, habit and not breaking it per se. And technology is all about forcing you to break it. So technology by itself, I think, is you know, like we've sent people to the moon 50 years ago, and we're contemplating it again now. So the tech was there. How it gets applied, what the priorities are, where the geopolitics of that get applied at a micro level and at a macro level. All these eventually drive what can convert that to a big business idea. So if you want to be cool about tech, I think you can sit and fund R&D or be in labs necessarily and get a kick out of that. There's nothing wrong with that. But eventually I get paid to actually generate capital over capital. And it's a choice I've made. So you can't forget the fact that you have to build businesses. And I don't think businesses are driven by tech, but half a dozen layers on top of that. So, I mean, in a nutshell, basically, The Economist is my guiding light, right? So you want to read it cover to cover so that you're informed on where you think the world is going. You might, may or may not subscribe to all the views, but you need those kind of viewpoints, is my view.
Got it. I want to rewind the clock, Karthik. Again, this is more of a selfish ask because I get asked this question all the time.
Sure.
I went to IMA from 97 to 99, and then I went to London Business School from 04 to 06. So the question that gets asked is why LBS after a good degree at IMA? I noticed you went to IMB and subsequently to Wharton.
Yeah.
A few years later.
Yeah.
So how did you think about it, and what do you tell people when you get this question?
So yeah, we're all clubbed as the double MBAs, right? so we are bound to get the question a lot.
I tell people I didn't get it the first time, so I had to read it twice to really get the concepts.
No. So I say I have a different answer. I met my wife while I was at the second program, so it justifies itself. so fate.
That's the business case. Yeah.
So fate apart, I think in some sense that is the answer, right? I think mentally, I'm almost guilty of over planning. So in my roadmap, wanting to be in the US, wanting to do a quality MBA after I've gained sufficient experience in my field of interest.
Right.
At least what I set out to do as an engineer was plan A actually. So my situation is a little different, where I actually had all these admissions and scholarships to consider and didn't unpack in IIM Bangalore for 2-3 weeks because I was still contemplating whether I should just go.
Oh, you had a fork in the road at that time itself.
Yeah. So, and that was not for an MBA though. And that will kind of answer your question as well as to what advice I give. That was for an MS, but the plan was the same. I would go there, do 2 years of master's because I needed an entry point into the US, probably in operations research or optimization, areas which I still curiously love and fund a lot of, though I don't have time to get into the guts of those. But those were areas of interest. And then I thought, yeah, then it opens up an avenue to work in the US for 3-4 years. And then the MBA is the natural extension of that because I enjoy these piecing together all the elements of tech, business, etc. And the professors who had come back to IMB convinced me that this was the place to be. They had come back from the US. Mm-hmm. In fact, I met all of the guys who had come back from the US. That was my diligence. It worked out okay. I think, again, there's no regrets, right? So there was a great experience at American Express for 3 years, a global organization sitting in India, in Bombay. But it felt like that itch to go and work overseas and experience overseas, mm-hmm. that had never gone away. And I still highly recommend it to people. If there's an avenue to get abroad in any form, the path, as long as you have a clear sight of the end goal, I think the path will figure itself out. And I tried to go laterally through a job, but none of the jobs were the kind I wanted. And so curiously, fate led me to thinking, if I get into a very, very good B school, then it justifies it. And I got into one and so packed up my bags and left. Didn't think that much about it. And 2-3 transformational things happened, right? As I said, I met my wife there and made great friends. So I think business schools are about networks.
Yeah.
So how can you not appreciate that you've just bought yourself into a global network?
Sure.
A lot of them have come back and, you know, people are LPs in my fund. Those networks still are very valuable. And so there's no second guessing that. The question is, and actually for the business that I do, networks are very powerful. So it's almost like I went and did a second MBA for all my portfolio founders in retrospect,
right?
They're gaining from it. So there are a lot of young Indian entrepreneurs who, by choice of what I do today, are actually gaining from my networks.
Leveraging your balance sheet of relationships.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And so I think there's no crime in it per se, as long as you know that you've gotten something uniquely different in the second time around. Though I think the need for it is dying down. I think if your head is clear about that's the end state, I would advocate differently. I don't think this fresher going into an IIM is a good idea. It's avoidable if you can. If you're just hungry for, like, you know, being in a classroom back again, competitive, don't want the kind of jobs that you're getting, you're smart enough, you think you can crack a CAT like exam and go into an IIM, which still is 50% of the class, then maybe you should do it. And but today, on the flip side, the opportunities for those graduates have changed dramatically.
That's true.
Yeah, when we were the last batch where of IMD who had zero foreign placements come into the batch,
right.
Other than maybe Olam, actually, or some of the trading houses which came on, unfortunately, day six, day seven, they were thought they were not sexy enough. That's changed dramatically.
True.
So if you're truly, truly driven, either you choose that first path and say the work experience really doesn't matter. But if I had to put my wisdom hat on, yeah, work for 3, 4, 5 years if you can, and then go enjoy the MBA. And I think that's the reality. You just enjoy the class, the interactions, the professionalism a lot more. IMB was an extension of Roorkee.
Very true. I think for me also, I could relate because when I finished IIT Madras, the choice was between going to UT Austin for a master's and taking a job in one of the companies or going to IMA.
So you know the story.
Disparate choices. Yeah. But again, mine was sort of I didn't do as much research as you did, but it was one of those fears of not being able to come back, sort of the X equals X plus one trap that a lot of people get into. So I said, let me maybe de-risk that.
Yeah.
It was as shallow as that. But anyway. And moving on, Karthik, you've been an investment banker, you worked on the tech side, and you worked in corporate roles. What was the trigger for you to get into early stage investing, if you were to think about the time you took that step?
So, series of steps. I think it was, so when I went to the US, I went writing my essays. My essays basically said that I wanted to be a Wall Street guy.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So, that was the natural path because I didn't know anything else. I land up there and find that, and this was the 99 boom year in the valley. So, I was there and I did a Silicon Valley trek and a Seattle trek, and it was transformational.
Hmm.
I actually went for a demo day, like a demo session or a conversation in Amazon and Microsoft. And so, we were looking at all the cutting edge companies back then, and it just sort of, I think the switch went off saying, this is where I want to be. Not necessarily the valley per se, but at the middle of understanding how technology can be transformational to business.
Hmm.
And that could be sitting inside of a financial services company. It could be sitting inside of a telecom company. And those are the kind of jobs I started looking for suddenly. Unfortunately, it never played out. The bust happened before even the summer internships. And people in the US is very specialized. So either you take this like leap of faith and somehow stick around in a geography and make it work, which may have happened. But when you combine visa issues and all of that, it becomes complicated. And so, took the view that, you know, let me try and get as much work experience around these areas that I like. And as a result, I got like this mishmash of work experiences over a decade in a telecom software startup, in a Reuters-owned company, which was basically a tech-led brokerage, what were called ECNs, Electronic Communication Network.
Yeah.
And when they got, when that company got sold to NASDAQ, Instinet, the trigger was like, I'm still not doing what I want to do. And maybe I should come back to India and invest 5 years into figuring out what I can eventually get into. And venture was always on top of my mind. These firms that you see today in the industry were just getting born then.
And why the move to India? Why was that a part of the equation as against doing this in the US?
I think it just takes much longer if you haven't had your... Fate hasn't dealt your cards well.
Hmm.
So if you're in the wrong industry, wrong geography, no visa, you need a visa sponsorship, you don't have experience, very specialized economy. So if they say, oh, you haven't worked in
there's
venture,
no
why should I? Why should I take you?
Hmm.
Right? And I tried all of that. It's not like I didn't try. Had a startup idea going, thought maybe India is the right market for it, so I should come and sit here with that idea. So there's a bit of everything. Came here and realized that I've run out of all my savings with this idea. And I need to get back into the workforce. And again, struggled because no one could slot me here as well.
Mm.
And the venture guys were just starting. So nobody was interested in taking one more US return guy who just had ideas and energy.
Right.
Early 30s back then. So, so again, in India, I had a multitude of experiences. Right? Both looking at media, telecom as a banker, and then... working eventually with the Times of India Group, which was fascinating because it's just such a vast array of media that you get exposed to. And in that process, thankfully, I started getting engaged with the early stage ecosystem because Times was thinking of a corporate venturing program.
Interesting.
So all of these, I think the timing, one, it came together. And again, if I take a step back, I know I have a lot of young 32-year-olds in the team, but there's no substitution for just the wisdom of working in 15 years across a multitude of industries, multitude of roles. And I honestly think it makes me a better venture capitalist. So you can, like, all entrepreneurs learn on the job. They're not born CEOs or CTOs, etc. Right? So similarly, I learned, I could have started at 32 and learned on the job. I think I'm better for the richer experiences that I gained. All of them add up. So eventually, to me, it somewhat ties into the first question, what do I do, why I do this? I think working with a proxy for what I could have done if I could clone myself is what I eventually end up funding, I think.
Sort of vicarious involvement in
absolutely. So it's one step removed. It's actually many steps removed. But I enjoy the actual active engagement with those founders rather than the passive. So you can sit in later stage companies and really not have that much of a touch with the core of the business. Or you can do early stage VC and actually influence a lot of things. We've done everything from stitching two co-founder teams together to naming a company, to all of those, right? So you could have done that three times perhaps in your lifetime, each one of those things.
Right.
Here, I think I do those two, three times in each cycle. And you're able to influence that. And that friendship and the trust that you build with these founders is just fantastic.
Right.
But you have to enjoy it, honestly. It's not, and I try to tell people that it's not something you can just copy a playbook. It has to be a personality. And we've tried very hard to see whether we can distill that culture into the firm. And not everyone's going to be a clone of me, but the most important facets of what makes us as bloom is something I try to enforce back into these kids as well.
And if you were to double click on that, Karthik, what are the two, three, let's say, elements of your culture which makes Bloom distinctive?
So I think clearly it's to respect what an entrepreneur is trying to do. And a lot of the times, I think people who have capital or people who have made it are sort of dismissive of a point of view which is not theirs. And you can be dismissive by saying a polite no, but you don't have to be dismissive of their effort to be an entrepreneur. And it feels very basic when I'm saying it this way.
It's a very nuanced point.
But it's so difficult to actually not lose sight of the fact that it's some kid who's staking, or some middle-aged guy who's staking his life trying to make something out of themselves, and you're just being dismissive of the effort because for some reason you think you're a cool VC and it's not a fundable idea and you're smarter than that other person. And those are like big, big red flags. I've actually rapped colleagues on the knuckles if I even sense it in an email. It just feels like an anathema of like why we exist, right?
Sure.
So that's one. Second is your own point of view and your ability to defend it. If you are, as an early stage investor, if you're copying somebody's point of view, you might as well leave the job.
Yeah.
Right. It might be wrong, and I'm willing to pay for that learning, which is why we are so picky on managing risk, managing risk, managing risk. Don't ever lose too much money because it's all learning. Don't ever say you knew this for sure. You don't. Right. And you are going to lose money. So make sure you lose as little as possible. Correct it. Iterate, make it bigger. Or if things start working, then you double down, triple down.
Got it.
Right? So driving those philosophies around risk management, I think, are very important. Not everybody comes with it in their head. But for me, it's a guiding force, especially in venture. Because nothing is set, nothing is established. Even 10, 15 things can go wrong. I mean, I've been meaning to write like a piece on what these are. But we've just seen when we do 100 plus companies, their patterns.
Sure.
But you can't predict them in advance. It's like walking to a party and saying, I know these three couples will get divorced. How the hell do you know? You just, like, you have social banter with them, right? But don't they? Yeah, in 10 years, don't 3 out of 25 get divorced? They do, right? Why is it any different in a startup environment? So there are so many things that can go wrong, and you shouldn't lose sight of the fact that you know what's going to work for sure. So you keep hedging against that. So I think that philosophy of understanding, you know, what founders' problems are and trying to solve for them is very, very critical for us. It's not like board meeting to board meeting.
Sure.
It's like, you know, and for that, you'll have to gain an immense amount of trust from the entrepreneur. I'll be honest, the disclosures that an entrepreneur on average makes to Bloom today in 2017 versus when we started in 2011, it's been like a scale of 3:1, 4:1. And that's just because...
A function of the trust.
One is that, of course, the brand building helps.
Sure.
And but even then, they're just cynical. You walk into a room as with your investor. You're an investor at the end of the day, right?
Sure.
First instinct of the human being is to hide all the flaws. Mm. Right? And you actually have to have that kind of a relationship with the founder that they're exposing all the flaws. Only then can you solve for them. We've had like co-founder splits announced to us after the like virtually one side has served the papers to the other. That's ridiculous, right? When you put it in context. Mm. But yeah, because you're an investor, you've been kept out of the conversation. So it's, I think, I know I've touched upon a lot of points, but that's the DNA of an investor. You should be able to, you know, sort of incent that kind of behavior from a founder.
Got it.
So it's a long cycle. Mm. You, how much ever we blog about this or we talk about this, it takes 6 months, a year, 2 years. For them to eventually say, I'll come to you with everything, as long as you have time. And then you say, no, I don't have time.
It's about creating the climate for that conversation, right? And yeah.
Eventually, you actually put your hand up and say, I can't solve everything.
Yeah, it's a tightrope. Yeah,
it is a tightrope. Yeah, true. It's like, you know, it's a partner. You want to be a partner, but like you have to draw lines.
With limits. But actually, picking up on a couple of things, very nuanced points about having a point of view and having the humility, if I may. I think it's a gross simplification of the first point you made.
Sure.
But how does that translate into how you hire? How do you look for these traits, which are quite hard and nuanced?
Very, very challenging. So our hiring has been like a little serendipitous in that sense. Mm-hmm. It's been self-selected, let me say. So it's, if it's someone who's actually coming and literally putting a resume and saying, I think you're an interesting firm. I want to work with you. That might be a good starting point. There's no harm. That's the right way to write a mail. But it's never going to be how or the reason why it eventually materializes into a potential hire. So all our hiring has actually been through networks, relationships, built over anywhere between 6 months and 18 months.
Hmm.
And the first, if I have a second conversation with someone and I think they need to want it more than I want them, to be honest. So they need to want to come and learn about what our motivations are. It's almost like a conversation that you are having with me right now. So if they haven't had
the curiosity.
Yeah, they haven't had the curiosity to come and actually ask me why I do what I do, what's the philosophy of this firm, what are we building towards, then they're thinking it's another job. And, you know, these things hit me like a bag of bricks about a year and a half ago. We were trying to draw out our first fund. All our team members, employees, whatever you want to call them, all colleagues as I would call them, that's how we introduce each other in every mail.
Sure.
There's no designations per se, it's just a name card. They were underpaid like crazy. We just had a tiny fund, very little fees. So their motivations had to be that they're coming here for the learning, literally.
Sure.
And I was okay with that. I couldn't afford to pay, so I said, anyone who wants to learn, I'll get a decent amount of work out of you, and I'm paying you a pittance anyway, so there's no debate about that.
With some skin in the upside?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
So, classic, I mean, we'll share carry and all of that. But the equations were changing dramatically in fund two. So, people were like, we're tired of being underpaid. Mm-hmm. We've done the learning. Mm-hmm. Now, you need to make a judgment call on whether we are the right people for the future.
Fair.
And these are my demands, right? So, I want to be close to market comp. I want this kind of a carry. And somewhere like, to me, intuitively, they felt like outrageous.
Right.
And so I went back to the drawing board and for the first time assessed, what am I building? Who are these guys? Are they aligned with me? How do you align incentives for a venture capital firm? And realized that there are You can't fake it. It's the same journey that I'm on, is what they need to be on for them to be able to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they can take the learning and go. They can start a firm. I don't know if you've noticed, there's been a little bit of a trend in VCs where a lot of analysts and associates, etc., have actually joined startups or are doing startups themselves.
Interesting.
So I actually advocate the other way around for joining the firm. And I almost mandate that you must have done something entrepreneurial. And if you haven't, then go and join a firm which is doing something. Sit there for a couple of years. And then, you know, you've placed a bet. I'm not guaranteeing you a job. We did that with one of our guys, Rohan, who joined. We poached him back from our portfolio company. So we told him, no, we don't have, at that point, it was truly not having the ability to hire one more person. But he took on the challenge and it paid off for him, right? He went there, he played a more generic role, biz dev, corp dev, etc. And those are the kind of skills we wanted back in the firm. So I think it's not a boilerplate set of skills.
Sure.
And that's the biggest challenge. So you're testing more for these softs.
Intrinsics, yeah. Some of the inner drivers.
I think the other part can be trained.
I hear you.
Yeah.
With you.
And I think it's not about complex DCF analysis or...
And that stuff doesn't show up on the CV, right? That's a challenge.
Yeah. And even if it did, it's not that relevant for us.
Correct.
And as we are growing, we are learning so we can teach them as well.
Sure.
Right. What makes a great IPO company?
Right.
I'm learning it too. Because I checked in it like 10 crore valuation. So I'm shooting something which has grown 100 times in value. So in that journey, we're trying to chronicle our stories and teach them.
Sure.
So I think I'm only looking for the basic ingredients.
Karthik, moving on, why don't we double click on life of a VC investor? And maybe a good place to start might be to say, what does your typical day look like? Typical day is probably a misnomer in itself, but how does the pie chart of time look in terms of where you spend energy and time?
So, I think you have to differentiate between a typical VC day, and since you're asking me, and I wear two hats every day, which is that of the entrepreneur.
True.
And my day job, which is like going and actually managing a portfolio in a pipeline process like a VC.
It's a good point. Let's maybe talk about both.
Yeah. So I think, some VCs, some of my peers have the good fortune of having the fundraising, the organization building, not be a part of their role.
Fair.
So in my case, unfortunately, that's part and parcel. So, but if you, and there are obviously seasonal peaks and ups and downs.
Sure.
So if you just normalize that, like when I'm going to China for a week, it's all a particular type of learning and job.
Sure.
If I'm going to the US for 2 weeks, it's almost all investor related. At least it spikes at 50%.
Yeah, we're looking for a long term.
Yeah, so yeah, the longer term, over the year, I think what's happening is I'm spending about 20% on fundraising, which is my raw material. Who are my investors? It's not like a typical startup which has investors who might spend, say, 5% of their time on investors. I have to spend 20 because that's my business. Money is my raw material. So they're my customers too. So I have a two-sided marketplace for taking capital and giving capital.
Sure.
So I have to cater to the entrepreneur wanting to love me and my investor wanting to love me eventually. That's when a great VC firm is made. So I have to focus on that aspect. And then the running of the business, the administration of the business, small things like, you know, logo, the brand, what you do for the events, what should the menu be, everything.
Sure.
You have to have a final checkpoint because your brand's at stake.
Yeah.
So I would say the fundraising is clearly 20%. I would say the organizational stuff is 15 to 20%. So that's already, unfortunately, takes away, unfortunately, I say, because I'd rather do the other part 100%.
Right.
But it's a trade-off. I mean, would I work for someone else or do I work for myself?
Fair.
And get the upside. It's a trade-off. So 40% goes towards my entrepreneurial hat, which is I have to run the business. I have to bring in the moolah. It's like the CEO kind of hat.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a CEO role, but I'm saying as
it's
a founder.
An institution building kind of a hat, yeah.
And then the other 60%, I would say, is one-third pipeline, two-third portfolio. So the pipeline, once in a while, you feel like, I don't need to invest right now, so I should just take a break from it. But actually, it's your fodder for learning. So if you're not meeting enough young people, different technologies, often enough, you can get rusty very quickly in this industry.
That's how you stay current in the market, right?
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways.
That's our business, right? We have to be ahead of the curve. Mm. And so if you're not seeing what's at the peripheral edge of the curve, then you're already behind. So you can't distance yourself too much. But on the other hand, your money is already sunk into your portfolio. So that is the biggest chunk.
Right.
So it's and I think if you go to one level lower, since we're on the topic, I think the other two parts will shrink to about 10-15% at most. What value they're giving back to the organization. And they would also similarly have a 2/3, 1/3 split. But it'll be of a much bigger chunk of their time.
Understood.
More like 80-90% of their time is available, unlike 60% of my time.
Got it. Fair enough. And going back to VC investing as a career option, one of the things I'm always curious about is, you know, what are the must-haves or nice-to-haves, both in terms of experiences and traits for people to succeed in this profession? And specifically, I'm curious about what's different here versus investing at different points of maturity, let's say PE investing or, you know, seed investing. Again, I'd love for you to double click on your take on what's the recipe for success, if that is one.
Yeah, so I think seed and VC are somewhat similar.
Correct.
The traits are about the same. Mm. I think the weightages are different. Mm. What I mean by that is, so at least I'm a strong subscriber, and I think broadly the whole world will agree to the same traits, that in seed and venture, you're pretty much have to have a grip on, as the market view becomes important because market sizing is very important. Mm-hmm. In seed and venture, you're playing a lot of high-risk bets and hoping that some become massive, which means you can't ignore market sizing anymore. Mm-hmm. There is no concept. Angel is very different. Mm-hmm. Angel, you're playing for your own money. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind putting money in a beer house, which gives me 10 times my money. Mm-hmm. Does that? But if that journey was 10 crores to 100 crores, as a VC, it's totally uninteresting. Because I'm not looking for predictable small multipliers in dollar terms. So that's the difference, right? Which, by the way, is more like private equity investing. Mm. So I'll come back. So it's almost like
The risk-reward profile is very different, is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so if you're doing seed and venture, therefore, you're playing every bet you're making, you're hoping that you're shooting for the moon. Mm. And relatively speaking, so one could be a $100 million moon, one could be a $1 billion moon, but their moons never
It's not a $10 million moon. Yeah.
There's nothing like a $10 million moon in the venture business, right? So when you're shooting for that, then you have to truly want and enjoy shaping your views from the market and where the world is going. You can't sit in a corner and say, I'm distanced from everything and I can build despite that. All market forces influence you.
Yeah.
Customers, regulators, who will put money into your companies next, IPO markets eventually, everything. And then, of course, what every VC on the planet will tell you, founders, team.
Yeah.
So your entire judgment is on judging people, and which is what I've realized is a super tough job, judging where people might be 5-7 years from now. Hmm. In terms of their maturity, their ability to scale an organization. Do you see this guy as a CEO of a 100-person company? Hmm. Because reality is, 9 out of 10 times, that's the odds you're playing for.
Right.
You're not going to get in a professional CEO at that level. And it's not about him and two buddies somehow figuring it out. Can he scale to that? And those are not trivial, is what I've realized. Mm. In private equity, all these risks are stripped out. Mm. You're not playing for any of these risks, actually. You're just playing for business model risks, founder integrity, because you're giving him a boatload of money. And in India, the fear typically is people, when they're giving that money to these founders, they figured out the founder got here without too much money. He knows how to cut every corner. Mm. So can I trust him? Can I trust him to use my money wisely or only in his self-interest? Hmm. And that arguably is a problem everywhere, but I'm just saying the value systems and the ethics and lines are grayer in some parts of the world than in other parts.
Sure.
Right? There are not as many black and whites in India, right? And so private equity then becomes understanding competition, understanding whether this business model is viable, understanding whether I can grow 3x, 4x, and also knowing that I'd never want to lose money on this. So look at this mindset shift, right? I'm actually modeling an Excel model, showing it to my LPs and saying, I lose money 4 out of 10 times. It's built into the DNA. And there the guy says, I can't lose money even 1 out of 10 bets. And I've spoken to 3-4 PE investors and that's what they tell me.
Mm. So, and how do you, and with such a, when you're investing in an idea which is so nascent, how do you even mathematically model for risk, right? Just out of curiosity, is there an art?
No,
how much of it is an art versus a science, right?
It's all art actually, in the sense that the art is in the estimation. Hmm. The science is in the fact that we're also shamelessly feeding off existing data.
Hmm.
We're not geniuses that we are contemplating how this can get there.
Hmm.
So as much as people might say that around a Facebook, there was a proxy in a Google, they might not have thought Facebook might make that much money in advertising, but you have to make that proxy bet in your head.
Sure.
So at least at a certain point. In the early days, you're essentially saying, the US does that far better than us, and that's why they're the, you know, mothership of venture capital, is they're able to take this punt that if this is so sticky, if people are willing to spend time with something, eventually somebody will pay.
Hmm.
So if you tell me, is there a science to it? Of course there's a science to it.
Okay.
But is there an ability to know exactly how to value it? That's an art form, right? That's a punt, and it's market specific. I mean, no disrespect to anyone in India. Firstly, you wouldn't be able to build those kind of companies in India because we're not able to think that way. It takes 40, 50 years of evolution to think that way. So even if it did think, and now with no disrespect to my US peers, there's no way I would pay the same value in an Indian market, right? Because the market conditions are different.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Your ability to monetize, that's the science. Right? So, apples to apples, same company, I will pay half the value in India. And a lot of entrepreneurs crib and say, well, that's not fair. My peer is getting 2x there. So, yeah, go build
market,
in the valley.
Market conditions are different.
No, just go build in the valley.
Hmm.
You'll get it. You're that good, right?
Hmm.
How many Indians have emigrated? Their co-founders in 1/3 of the valley companies, from what I hear.
Hmm.
So, go do it there.
Hmm.
You're playing for these conditions. You also get a driver at 15,000 rupees, right? So choice, these are life choices, truly.
Right. Right.
Yeah, there you'll figure out, yeah, you'll ride in an Uber, you don't need a driver, but those are life choices. So there, you can't ask the VC ecosystem to adjust for, you know, different market absurdity that exists in some other market, right? So it is what it is. And so when people crib that, oh, VCs don't get anything here, the private equity, I said it's unfair comparisons.
Okay.
When cycles play out, people get bolder. And that's actually the art again.
Hmm.
It evolves because
hmm.
it's constantly an art form. So today, rules of thumb, since you asked that question, when I'm paying some guy more than 10, 15 crores of valuation, firstly, where does that number come from? It's basically actually how valuable is the founder's time? How good are they? They're committing 3-4 years to it. How solid is the idea? But it's not about that. It's actually how much to dilute the guy. How much money does he need to get there?
Mm.
So this is all scientific in some sense.
Fair.
And then you're working backward and saying, okay, whatever they do with my 3-4 crores of money, can they prove enough traction that they can get beyond 60-70 crores of free money in the next round? They can't. Then why would I pay more than 20?
Mm.
I want a 3x. That's my risk matrix. That differs from me to the next guy to the next guy.
Fair enough.
So those are the art forms which evolve. We all learn. Iterate, learn, iterate.
And you have your heuristic that evolves.
It's all heuristics.
Yep.
In a nutshell, that's the right way to.
Got it.
It's all heuristics. There's a market heuristic. There's a firm heuristic.
Correct.
And everybody plays by that.
Makes sense. And if I look at people that are successful venture capitalists and once again look at where they come from, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the experiences they've had, what are some of the patterns that emerge? Do you have a sense of what that pie chart might look like?
Honestly, I don't.
Hmm.
My sense is, even if you take entrepreneurs and you say, can all of them become great VCs? I don't think they can.
Correct.
In fact, the Valley, all this is hearsay, so I haven't seen data, to be honest. So I won't belabor the point too much, but most people say some entrepreneurs make good angels.
Hmm.
because that's their DNA, to be helpful, to help put a 100K to... They make terrible VCs.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a different job.
And the failure mode being? And the
two things. There's a discipline that you have to have around managing money.
Okay.
Okay, when it's yours, it's a different rule book.
Right.
When it's what's called opium in our industry, very jocularly,
uh-huh.
other people's money. Okay, so when you're dealing with
quite addictive. Huh?
Yeah, it's very addictive and it's a very different proposition. It's a different trap. It's not the same rule book. That's why I said you have to have a discipline around how you invest,
right.
how you exit, how you return money. And that's what my customers on the investor side actually appreciate.
Mm.
So if you're telling an entrepreneur who's built tech businesses to say now you're going to become a financial services business, which is what it is, it's not an easy jump.
Good point.
Second is the classic problem of entrepreneurs being very sure of what worked for them. And almost being in denial that other models can work.
Mm.
And I honestly believe every one of these legendary success stories is a different, slightly nuanced, different playbook.
Right.
The broad general principles of business are about the same, right? But if you look at the entrepreneur himself or herself, that I think it's a very different path.
Right.
Different backgrounds, different approaches, different team structures. So where's the playbook? And then people who have actually experienced it and built it a certain way don't know any other playbook.
Good point.
And find it very difficult to adapt and give the benefit of doubt to other folks. So fundamentally, I honestly don't know. It's a classic mix. I think people have come from working in startups, building startups, being in consulting, being in banking. And I haven't gone and done a resume review on seeing who pulled it off best.
And related point, Karthik, also, I'm curious about failure modes when people transition from one industry to another. You touched upon the failure modes when entrepreneurs move into investing because it's a different business and you need to move away from courage of conviction in your idea to being open to other ideas. Similarly, if we for a minute look at the failure modes when people move from consulting to VC investing.
Yeah.
And then if you could subsequently talk about banking to investing, are there two or three failure modes that people should watch out for?
I think they're all... It depends how deep-rooted your behavior is in your prior industry and how married to that behavior you are.
Okay.
And I think that will make you a poorer VC investor. I don't think it's that much about failure mode. I'm an advocate that everything teaches you something.
Correct.
So if you're able to take that as learning and apply, it's actually going to be very powerful.
Hmm.
If you take that as baggage and saying nothing else will work as well, it's a problem. So let's take those examples that you brought up, right? So if you take consulting, usually most people apply very well-established frameworks.
Hmm.
And venture is all about destroying them.
Right.
So, if you come and say, my skill is to apply the framework and build a new one and know where the world is headed and I'm going to be the innovator of that framework. And it's not like they have to be a genius. They just have to learn from the market.
Right.
They see six new different types of marketplaces working. You become an advocate. So, you will see a lot of guys who are like in the US, they're like blogs are followed by 100,000 people. And that's because they're thought leaders in this classic consulting mindset, consulting frame. Some of these are journalists, some of them are consultants,
mm-hmm.
but they've gone and applied that core skill to venture in the way they should. It can easily be a trap in the other direction and say, oh, this doesn't work.
Mm.
That's precisely the point. 9 out of 10 great businesses in using tech and disruption and the short life cycles that this is an exciting business, venture is an exciting business, happen only because you've disrupted an existing framework.
Got it.
Right? So that, I think, is the consulting trap. Banking, my sense, again, I might be wrong. Again, the best bankers who probably move to venture are truly, truly believe in very, very long-term relationships. And I think banking is conventionally a deal-making slash transactional deal.
Correct.
Right? Correct. There are some who will espouse that they're relationship oriented. There are some who maintain them. It's very tough when you have a year-end goal and you have a year-end bonus.
You need to keep a momentum, yeah.
No, but even if you worked with a great guy last year, if you can't contribute to your bonus for the next three, if you sold his company, let's say, what are you going to do with him? Your wealth arm might talk to him, but you have no reason to, right? So that's a much tougher thing to... they profess that, but how many actually practice it is the challenge. And in our business, you have to see the same guy for 8-10 years. My first fund guys are still thriving, right? Some are dead, but they still come back. So it is only a relationship business. So I might be reading too much into it, but I feel like that transactional DNA might get in the way.
Got it.
Right? Especially early stage. Because it's all about like nurturing, not dealing with and we did touch upon the entrepreneur pitfalls.
Karthik, moving on, I'm curious about the early few months whenever somebody joins a new place, right? Whether it's a new industry or a new company or a new culture. And specifically in the VC industry, what I find interesting is that it's a long lead time in terms of feedback of performance, right? It takes a while before you get a sense of how you're doing as an investor. So what's your experience or what's your advice to people to deal with the first passage of play till the real feedback starts kicking in?
So I think if they've already joined, it's too late for one part of the advice, which is what we give to a lot of people who come knocking on our door, which is saying find any avenue which allows you to work with startups as much as possible before formally enlisting as a VC. So even if you're doing it in your early 30s, as goes back to that exercise that I did for myself and for the team, if you're not ready for a 10-15 year journey, it's a non-starter.
Correct.
The economics are that way, leave alone just actually going through the success path. Even the economics are back-ended.
Yeah.
So why are you joining if you don't believe in the journey that long? So it's almost like committing to a 15-20 year journey / relationships, set of relationships, even with the people who run that firm, the philosophy of that firm, etc. And saying, I'm smart enough, give me the job. So we encourage a lot now, given the variety of portfolio that we have, so go join one of our portfolio companies. How can VC startup experience hurt? I mean, it's fantastic, right? You learn so much. And depending on what your skill set is, even though you might be a mature 35, 40 year old, advice is always go as early as possible. Not necessarily if you want to sign up as a co-founder and you fall in love with an idea, even better, go try out the journey. If you're successful, you make a lot of money. Otherwise, you've done exactly what we asked you to do.
Right.
It's like a mini MBA without, the additional cost. So
the opportunity cost of time being the cost,
That's the only cost. But you learn so much. Yeah. So, and we drive, and because we have portfolio choices today, we tell them, you pick a city, you pick a sector, I'll give you three options.
Interesting.
Okay. Now, what's interesting, and this is actually true of what happens post them joining as well, is for the first time they realize how much they're respected by the entrepreneur. And why is it any different if you're already having a VC visiting card versus actually being on the outside pitching to that entrepreneur? It's exactly the same. Why would an entrepreneur, once he's taken your money, why would he respect you for anything other than what value you can add to him? Right? So if you're sitting on the outside and you don't have that agenda, you still got to convince the guy that you're good enough to be in the firm. And if you actually had become the VC, so let's say this path ended in both of us agreeing that he's a good candidate and he came on board. And on day one, what locus standard does he have in the firm? Nothing. I probably trust him. The entrepreneur says, who's this kid? He might be 6 years younger than my colleague. But he says, who's this guy? What does he know? My relationship is with you. So we had this challenge in fund one. We picked a lot of the portfolio and then we parachuted in 2-3 guys. And the guys only want to talk to us.
Right.
So they get habituated to a certain, so which means now the job goes back to some of the characteristics I explained 30 minutes ago. If you're not able to win over the entrepreneur by the value you can add to them, the difference you can make in their day-to-day, he's going to say, I'll see you as little as possible and not as much as possible.
That's the only way you get access to the seat on the table. Right?
And if you're not seeing the entrepreneur as much as possible, you're not learning. So the first 6 months, 12 months, clearly, just forget about dreaming anything bigger than just learning. Maximize the number of meetings you can go to. track the partner, track your colleague, join in for the meetings, volunteer to help where you're not asked, win your way through. Because that's life for the next 20.
Hmm.
Why would he pick your money for 500K when he has 20 other choices? Hmm. It's exactly the same conundrum.
Hmm.
Just because I have a tag called Bloom, you're not necessarily a slam dunk.
True.
You have to go win over why he wants to work with you or she wants to work with you.
And my colleague in my previous firm, Egon Zender, would say, people pick the photographer, not the camera. Right? At the end of the day, are you the person delivering the value?
Which is also, by the way, I mean, though you didn't ask, I'll disclose it, is the secret sauce in venture capital. The greatest VC firms are built on the back of a reputation that they have the ability to make the founders arguably successful or feel good about the journey, some of those attributes. And so they want to work with the best VCs for that reason.
Hmm.
So the trick of the trade is actually, it's not about you saying, I know how to pick well. It's whether the best entrepreneurs want to pick you.
Very interesting. Sort of flipping it the other
way. In the US, it's more true because there is a dearth of...
Supply-demand equation is different, I guess.
It's very different. Here, arguably, wherever you get the money from, you'll work with it. It's a very compromise-oriented marriage.
Mm-hmm.
There, you can actually choose your partner if you're really good.
Mm.
Maybe not that true in India, but this is valid if you want to be a great VC, irrespective. That's my point. So even if the guy was, if you're being an asshole about it and you have 10 such founder relationships, I'm sure you're not going to get great companies in the next cycle working with you. So that's the learning, basically. But to be humble about the fact that it's all learning for the first few years.
Got it. And what surprises people the most? Again, the reason I ask this is, at least when I see people transitioning careers, a lot of the transition.
Obviously, the classic stereotypes, right? People think this is a flashy, you know, it's a very cool business to be spotting like cool technology and cool founders and cutting checks. And the fact that you are empowered to cut checks eventually, if not in the first year, in the third year. Even in our case, for the first 2 years, they don't feel the pain. When third year, when you say that your incentives are aligned to how your sub-portfolio performs, you're responsible for that 500K. That's when it dawns on them for the first time that they're actually responsible for some money. And now I have to educate them and instill in them that it's not my money, it's not your money. It's somebody's money. I've gone and put my name, my brand's name, etc., and reputation on. So if you screw up, it's okay. I'll take some of it as learning costs so that you become a better VC in my next cycle. But then don't ask for rewards and don't ask for arguably sticking around, right? So that's when it dawns upon them that, oh my God, this is about a process discipline in picking, in learning what's out there. And then cutting the check is the easiest part of the job. You need to actually nurture and watch this investment. And 90% of this country still hasn't figured out how to systematically exit. And so that conundrum is still in everybody's head. Like, what have we done in the last 10 years? Have we figured out the entire cycle?
Right.
So all the sexy part is fine. And here, I mean, people used to revel at, my company got a $10 million round. What does it mean? It just means there's 4 more years of the journey.
Right.
There's more grind. A different set of problems.
It's a start of a journey, right? It's
different
journey.
Problems. Yeah. Everything is a sub-journey and you feel like, I set a milestone, but is that the end state?
Hmm.
Is it the finish line in terms of a grand exit? It's not, right?
Hmm.
It's a stage one, stage two, stage three kind of a thing.
Got it.
And so initially we used to think our job is to get it to stage one's end, right? And then you get it there and then you realize it's an entirely different set of problems.
Hmm.
It's like a video game where the obstacle courses change and you don't know what they're like.
Hmm.
And you don't know your player skills versus what the challenges of that particular market are. It's not apples to apples ever.
Hmm.
One guy is building something which is competing against, Paytm. One guy is building something which is competing against a global marketing tech company.
Right.
So, and that's when humility dawns at you and saying, I have to start focusing. I have to start understanding what I'm good at.
Got it.
Right? That could be sector, it could be geography, it could be the type of founders, it could be the stage of risk I'm ready to take. And that's when the penny drops, I think. So all the glamorous stuff goes away.
Got it. So that brings me to the next question, Karthik, which is, how you evaluate an entrepreneur And specifically, I'm curious about this, at least in my head, there's a tension between two different elements, right? One is about the entrepreneur being having a certain dogged persistence about an idea. The other is about the entrepreneur being open and willing to input when new funders come in. And it's a fine line. You don't want people on either side of the spectrum. So how do you sort of walk the tightrope from a judgment standpoint at the time of investing and along the way?
So I'll answer the first question, which is around what do we look for in the founder?
Yeah.
So, and which actually leads into the next question. Capacity to learn, listen, not be obstinate beyond a point is very, very important in my view. And we'll come to the second question, but because you intertwine the two questions interestingly, the more stubborn they are in taking inputs in such an early stage of the business, the more unlikely they are to succeed in my view. Because actually at the early stage, you don't know anything. You don't know the challenges of organization building, what the problems set can expand to, which direction it can go to. And that is what actually we look for in a founder. So all of these are interlinked. So what I mean by that is, essentially we realize that great founders have two sets of qualities around organizations. That it's not about them, it's about building phenomenally great teams. And across the board. So philosophically, you have to be willing to share rewards. You have to be willing to share responsibilities. You have to be willing to therefore take inputs.
Yeah.
You have to respect them. It's not about a paper exercise of building a team. If you're not surrounding yourself with views of people who you respect, then why bother? Right? So, and then extending it one step further, they have to respect that we are partners as opposed to us versus them. And again, if they don't, they will obviously disregard our inputs. So the two are intertwined, and these are the characteristics you're typically looking for. Do they appreciate the feedback that you're giving? And so it's a double-edged sword. Like if that's why I said if you're being arrogant about your views, a lot of founders become cynical about why the hell should I take the VC's views? Or anybody for that matter. Let's say 9 out of 10 people in the world broadly, and we see it a lot more in India than we should in my view. And which is why the valley is the valley I keep saying. Culturally, the valley will not like dismiss you.
It's a little bit of the how you engage, right? I think.
Yeah, and because the ecosystem engages, these guys become harsh. They put up more barriers and stop listening than they should.
Very interesting.
Even though they might have not started that way. Because they're getting so much pushback from customer, from investor, from, you know, some bigger company.
It's the climate that drives the behavior, right? Yeah.
In some sense. So we have to, which is what we work very hard to refine, right?
Very interesting.
For example, we'll tell our founders that go and meet your competitors. Go and have like open dialogues. Learn from each other. See where you might compete in the future. There's no harm. Don't sit and bitch about it without even meeting each other. Which happens. It doesn't happen. But that's the kind of openness we try to build because I take another view, right? Been in it for 6 years now. I don't see myself doing anything else in life. If I'm doing this for another 20, 25 years, I better be in an ecosystem I like to be in. So how much ever it's been corrupted by somebody else.
That's an enlightened, self-interest at play, I guess.
Absolutely. I'm saying, what the hell? I'm not going to live with a crappy ecosystem and put my life through this. So I want it to be better and I will fight it. So I blog about it. I blog about the behavior because I said, if I don't fix it, then I'm to blame too.
Sure.
So that's one aspect. The other aspect I think is truly whether they're passionate about solving a very specific problem and not one of the other two things. So you say, what's unique in that? I'll tell you what's unique in that. There are lots of founders who think there is a fashionable problem to solve. That's not the founder we're looking for one. And the classic, unfortunately, entrepreneur hat that India was willing to put on people was as long as you know ki achha business karta hai, ya achha paisa banata hai, to achha entrepreneur hai. That's not startup venture investing. That's every other type of investing, but it's not venture capital early stage. If you're trying to pick there and saying, I want a decent probability that this succeeds, you have to be, have, and look at the odds that are stacked against you. We've been talking about it for now. It has to be that this person is passionate around solving something in the world. Even if he's truly like hardcore Madhu Guju style wants to make money, it's got to be around that. Then that passion comes through and it reflects in hiring, it reflects in your ability to build a business, capital, every element of not perfectionism, but like a great product and brand that you build. Without that, it's just danda. Let's get it done, right? And I think there's a huge difference. The second difference is it's not about just the problem you're chasing. Sometimes people fall in love with the solution they're selling.
Very interesting.
So they say, my product is a rock star product. You're saying customer doesn't think so. No, but I don't care. Mine is a rock star.
It goes back to the listening point, right? Yeah.
So if you don't know how to listen to your customer and adapt and not lose sight of the fact that you are solving the same problem, please focus on the problem, not on the solution.
But how do you suss this out at the time of evaluating the entrepreneur? What?
I think you question them on whether they have thought through what behavior they're influencing, why are they doing this, where was the origin of the problem in their heart, right? Why did they think they should chase this idea? Sometimes backgrounds to throw up cues on this. So Sam Altman gets credit for it. A lot of us think, but he blogs it better. So Sam Altman says, I always start with the childhood. Right? And so you want to understand the person deeper and their motivations, not simply the fact that they came up with a cool idea in a college lab and decided they wanted to become a startup entrepreneurs. That might be good enough. I'm not saying no. But at least ring fence the risk.
Got it.
Right? That's all I'm saying.
And as a startup grows, Karthik, what have been your observations around inflection points where the organization begins to overtake the entrepreneur in terms of the leadership required, right? I guess in a lot of these situations, since you're betting on an exponential growth, there's risk of the business or the organization becoming too big for the person at the driving seat. Where do you see, is there a pattern around when that discontinuity starts getting amplified?
So, again, unfortunately, I think there are too many schools of thought. So I wish I could slot things and put a formula around it. I honestly still am struggling for it. And the legendary stories, right? Whether that's Steve Jobs or equivalent, you know, if you look at actually Musk's, Elon Musk's ventures, he's only built one from scratch. All the others, he's actually gone in as that guy who needs to be parachuted to take the idea to greatness. Even Travis, for that matter, in the Uber idea, you're not the original guy who thought of it. The idea was someone else's. So I think it's, therefore there are examples on all sides is what I'm trying to say. And then you take a Jobs who was a college dropout and then he got conflicted. He had a management style. He was never willing to reform. And then the guy will say, boss, you own X percentage of the company. The board runs the business. I will tell you how it should be run and kicks him out. So where's the playbook here? There's no playbook, right? I think what a good founder and good investor slash board should constantly educate and monitor is, should we keep looking for good people even ahead of their time? So you don't wait for inflection points to perfection. Then it always becomes contentious, is my view.
Understood.
Right? So if you think XYZ, and so your point around, you know, is it around a funding milestone? Is it around a revenue milestone? I wish it was so predictable only because the path of the startup itself has not become predictable in India. So then to try to build predictability around any of these is very, very difficult. So I'm not joking. I think I've noticed a lot of firms which go either a funding or a revenue or a growth spike and then actually flatten out for a bit because they're figuring all this out.
At some stage you say, maybe I should take care of the shop, right? Look inward and then...
So the board starts saying, what's going on? Who's fixing this? Then suddenly you get a sales head and realize that the co-founder is a great passion selling, one-off selling guy. Terrible sales process guy. And so suddenly you realize that sales just... By just fixing it with one guy and bringing process, it went 2x next year. Something as subtle as that, right?
Right.
So, but that's a lot of work. It took 1 year and 6 board meetings to convince the co-founder that he's just not cutting it. Right? So, my point is, where is the, like, you
there's
know...
There's no pattern, right?
There's no milestone.
True.
It's a continuum.
Fair.
So, all I'm saying is, as long as your capital can afford it, that's the other challenge. How much money do you have in the bank? Which kind of resources are you likely to pull? who in the market is interested in joining you? Is such talent even available? Have they played the playbook that you're getting them to try and solve the playbook? Right? So all of this is evolving as we speak. In 2011, these were like, what are we talking about, boss? Let's just get to the next stage. Right? In 2015, we're saying, guys, XYZ Freshdesk has a playbook in this. Dhruva has a playbook in this, in enterprise. In consumer, three guys have built massive 100x scale in 3 years. Shopclues, delivery, whatever. Sure. Yeah. Let's go and talk to them. Let's go. And, so we have a company called Dunzo. Mm-hmm. Arguably, like it's like a pre-A company. They've raised about 2 million, but it's like very tiny, right? What is 2 million? They hire us from Uber. Where was this guy 5 years ago? You would learn the job on your own, no? So I think it's a combination of the founders themselves scaling and recognizing where they're not able to scale, point A. And then the ecosystem giving you enough resources,
right,
both in terms of capital and people. And when those choice sets all come together, the answers emerge. If the board and the driver and the founders are sleeping on the wheel, somebody will overtake you. Okay. Or you'll miss the growth, you know, boost that you could have got.
Right.
That's a trade-off. So you just, that's what I'm saying. Now we begin to realize that you've got to be so damn conscious of this well in advance. So I'm seeing that in one company recently. I introduced them to like somebody who can be a powerhouse. Now that guy may not join them, but I'm opening five conversational paths open up.
Got it. You're seeding the thought right here.
So if you don't do it now, we won't even find the right person 1 year from now. That guy may join in 3 months and we might be home. But that's like asking for miracles.
And you're right. And it's just like how you spoke about hiring for Bloom. It's a journey. It's never a transaction over 3 months. It's a journey of engagement and chemistry.
We have a company called Belong, where Vijay is like obsessed about culture and fit and all of that. And that fellow will do like due diligence on everybody, on every guy, on every employee, on every investor. Because it's a dream. It may or may not be as relevant in the end state. But in his mind, that's the journey.
Fair.
So I wish everybody thought that way. It's not about filling spots. It's true. About filling, like, if you want to build a truly, truly great company, more of these ingredients are in place, the higher the probability. Somebody can turn around and say, no, no, I did it without all this bullshit. But the point is, you're reducing the odds. Fair. And that's all we're trying to do, always increase the odds.
Fair. And as you look at your portfolio of companies, again, we spoke about risk-reward. And finally, it's a portfolio approach, right, where if you make 10 investments, maybe a small fraction of them goes on to give you the returns, disruptive returns.
Yeah.
And if you look at the ones that don't, sort of, let's say if 2 out of 10 grow to give you disruptive returns, if you focus on the 8, is there any, again, patterns around what the bottlenecks are, which come in the way of them reaping these returns? I'm just taking numbers for the sake of conversation. But let's say out of 10 investments, if 1 or 2 really explode and give you the disruptive returns, the other 8, I guess, taper off from a growth curve at some point. I'm just curious about, you know, we can focus our attentions on the 1 and 2, on what worked well there. But sometimes there are lessons in the other 8 as well.
Absolutely.
Right? In terms of what didn't go well. So I'm just curious about...
Yeah. I think all our learning comes from there. So often repeated...
That's where the traffic is, right?
Yeah. And often repeated quote, right? I mean, it's not objective that you go and say, I'm a hedge fund, I can run this strategy and I can replicate the success. That's far more, you know, you can sit in a corner room and replicate that model. In this case, it's not. Organization building, I mean, replicate the same damn success in Delhi versus Bangalore is different. Leave alone Valley here. Right? So you have to build a very different organization to build that same level of success. So I think that's lost on people.
Right.
Right. And therefore only the failures teach you very well. Because you know, bloody hell, we've seen this pattern now in 3 cases. What went wrong? They hired the wrong person or wrong co-founder fit or wrong investor, wrong, you know, allocation of capital, blew up money too fast. Then you get to the business side and you say marketplaces where you subsidize, you know, one side is okay, subsidize 2 sides is not. So you pick up a lot of nuanced learnings. And what I think as collectively we do is we all learn from it. We all discuss it in smaller teams. We don't publish as much.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the time to. We are not building in the 70s like the Valley was. Even if the 70s, if you learned it, how would you even talk about it? Probably in a club dinner, right? Mm. literally would have had to say Saturday, first Saturday is let's gather and chat.
Right.
Look at the choices you have. And people seem to be afraid. People seem to be hesitant. It's changing. There are people who blog about it. There are people who talk about it. Very early days. Mm. So a healthy debate is the best way the ecosystem as a whole will learn. And it's not a bad thing because the entrepreneur has to be conscious of this before getting into the journey.
Right.
Half of them are repeating the same mistakes which were done 5 years ago. This is embarrassing. That means we are not evolving. And all of us need to evolve.
And if you look at that pie chart of, let's say, the 8 failures, just to push that further,
yeah.
Are there any predictable patterns in terms of what that breaks into?
No, it's
I guess I'm seeking too much predictability.
It's broadly the same three buckets, which are selection criteria buckets.
Hmm.
That's where it breaks. It can't be different from that.
Hmm,
selection criteria buckets are three pronged. Market opportunity.
Yeah.
Founder plus team.
Yeah.
And in India, we changed it from the idea slash product. It has a role, but I would put that into the team bucket
yeah.
and say, do they have the capability to build a great product and leave it there?
Hmm.
The third bucket, interestingly, is the market opportunity for the business was one thing. The structure of the venture capital market dictates success failure too.
Mm-hmm.
And we put a healthy 20% weightage on that. It's 40-40-20. So if you look at failures, it's arguably disproportionately actually in that venture capital bucket because you fund a niche here, you won't get funded in the next round, right? If you build a sub optimal $50 million business, which in the US would have got acquired for $50 million, in India somebody will pay $5 for it.
Very interesting.
So you can claim that it failed, but the reality might be it was a good product, limited base. Was successful, it was not viable to bootstrap itself to a $50 million level, either because it's a consumer business which wasn't making money, or the founders got tired because they were waiting 4 years and they got $1 million or $2 million in revenue. Nobody was giving them money. They got tired of bootstrapping.
Hmm.
So when you look at the reasons, it'll always fall in one of these three buckets.
True, true.
Within them, there'll be 5-6 sub-variants.
That's fair. Moving to a different theme, Karthik, again, back to the point about the pace of growth of companies in early years and typically a lot of the entrepreneurs being quite young in terms of the experiences, life experiences, business experiences they've been
through.
Hmm. What are some of the, what have you seen in terms of good practice for entrepreneurs to scale up their leadership capability as the organization scales up? What do good entrepreneurs do?
I think they inevitably take a year or two, but the best entrepreneurs start sharpening the, you know, we used to joke about it in business school, vision, what is vision, what is mission?
Mm.
It's almost disastrous if you don't have it in a startup. It's counterintuitive, actually. The startup needs it more than the big organization.
Mm.
The big organization reflects it in the scale to which it's already been built.
And there's a certain momentum that takes it there, right? Yeah.
You go and find some part of, let's say, my last day job was with the Times of India, right?
Right.
You go and interview 10 people, you figure out the vision for yourself.
It's distributed enough in the organization, yeah.
It's there, right? Mm-hmm. It might not be perfect, but it'll be a 5 on 10 to 8 on 10 with everyone.
True.
In a startup, you don't define that. It can be 1 to 10. The founder thinks he gets all of it. Somebody down the line doesn't know. So one ability to articulate that, define that, and goes back to purpose. What are you solving? What are you building? Because to me, that attracts the best talent, that attracts the most missionary of team members, and eventually the leadership that you might want for your company, right? If they're not married to the idea and you're trying to hire them in, you better be at like a few $100 million of value. Somebody's coming for a job again.
Interesting.
Right? And so I found that the best founders actually are able to win the best people from the market basis this, not simply throwing money.
Vision and purpose. Hmm.
Which if you had thrown money, then you fall into these traps of having built random organizations at random scale. I would not random organize, random scale too rapidly without having any emotional connect with what you're building. So at first drop of a, you know, some situation, whether it's funding or whatever, all of them are out of the door.
Hmm.
It's a hunting for guys. Like, that's what I'm saying. If you are seeing, there might be, I'm coming up with empirical things on the fly, But it's like if you're coming up with a need to negotiate everybody's salary down by 20% 8 out of 10 times, it's probably a problem. Right? That means it's coming for the salary. It's not coming for what you're selling. And I think the best leaders I have seen have built on that former premise, having this in place. And, you know, we, again, all things which we, again, HR courses we used to laugh about, culture setting, it can go so wrong so quick, it's not funny.
True.
Because the organization is being, it's a baby, right? It's like teaching cuss words to a child. It can go very wrong. Right? And so it's so fragile in that sense that if the leaders are not working around fixing that very early, sometimes you're not capable. You maybe not confrontational, so you don't talk about it.
And actually, just building on that, are they at a point in time in life and maturity to understand the nuances? Back to your point about no substitute to experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Experience. No, you're right, and right in that. So some of them get it intuitively. That's why I think the best founders are the best founders, because they just get it. Others seek help, others don't, and don't get it. And so that's your matrix, right? The disaster waiting to happen, right? They should ask. And honestly, we didn't realize that that might be the biggest ask, or that box could be the biggest ask of us, right? In the various things that people can ask. And you don't know how to offer. You can't go there and start coaching them on this. It's got to be intuitive.
Sure.
So one, you're trying to gauge it at selection.
Right.
And then you're hoping that this person acknowledges who he's got on board and knows how to ask. Which is why, for example, I feel a lot of angels to me are very disappointing, because they think it's about cutting the 10-15 lakh check. It has nothing to do with that. It's about all of this. If you're not there for that person, you're effectively taking a blind punt on the fact that they will figure this out entirely on their own. And so the other interesting aspect is, which I think is a good predictor of this in the long term. We need to organize our data so that we can actually predict this with some probability. So who referred this person? So who do they look for mentorship? Who are they connected to?
Very interesting.
Who has judged them enough that he thinks it's worthy enough to risk their goodwill to pass on the lead to me?
That's curation there, right? Absolutely.
All sorts of behavioral curation has already happened, no?
Correct, correct.
So you just take that cue and run with it. That's exactly what we're doing in one case now. Pete came through, came through one founder. I think he's too emotional, so he wouldn't apply a different lens. We put him on another founder. Both founders we respect and love a lot. Both are Fund One founders. Both gave a thumbs up. We'll finally do the deal.
It's very interesting. If I were to sort of use my, one of the things that, who's now Rajiv, who's now the global CEO of Egon Zenda, he was a partner in Delhi. He would always say, when you source a leader through another referral whom you trust, who's an accomplished leader and a trusted leader, that always carries higher weightage, and you can pound the table with a lot more conviction.
Absolutely.
Than somebody that you pick up from LinkedIn. Just to sort of give you the
We get 3,000 pipeline, right?
Right.
Probably 750 to 1,000 are referred.
Right.
Now within that, there is some 10 grades of reference.
Correct.
A banker who met you at a conference also refers. Your founder refers. Your LP refers. Your friend refers.
Correct.
Everything is a different quality of reference.
Very true.
And if you're able to eventually build a... And so people say, I wrote this in my blog and said, unfortunately, you have to come to us referred to have a decent probability of even getting heard. That's a pipeline. Don't want to help you, but I want to say this up front.
That's why Wharton has letters of recommendation, right? I mean, everybody can write a CV. I mean, it's you need some market validation.
Absolutely. Right? And so in these cases, it's all about that. There, whatever said and done, you can't... Unless the guy is a criminal or something, he comes to us 2 years and goes away.
Actually,
here you're putting millions of dollars behind this person.
There's lesser of a pinch.
There is a bigger bet. He's paying, at least. Yeah, you're paying for that learning.
That's true.
So you better get it right as early as possible.
Got it. Lovely. Just a few things to wrap up, Karthik.
Sure.
We've discussed about a bunch of things, but three things that they didn't teach you at two business schools, just to make it...
to drive home the point. I think... I'll tell you what served me very well. And I think I didn't learn them at business school. I think. It's a little bit of personality and a little bit of iterative learning that helped me understand the world better.
Sure.
One is definitely importance of communication. how you communicate, when, where, why, how actually is a lot of the magic sauce. I don't think we paid any attention to it, right? I think you should just, that's all you should teach in business school. How do you deal with different stakeholders in life, right? If you can do that, you're like in most business situations, 80% of the way home.
Correct.
Right? You might not do transactions. That's what I said. You can turn down the person. How you turn the person down is the art.
Correct.
Right? How can you not teach that at business school? So I wonder about that a lot. That's definitely number one. The second, again, it's a personality thing. And and I don't know how you teach it, but I think it's always personal. It's never business. And just the hard learning again. Everything can come back to bite you. Right? And so where is the, and everything shapes you. So how does business, in this notion that it was described by, you know, some Wall Street dialogues or movies, that it's business, it's never personal. How is that again not filtered into your education? I mean, it's like going to parenting school and being told not how to parent. And being told, this is what happens in the second trimester, third trimester. But when the baby comes, I won't tell you
how. It's a fundamental disconnect, right?
I feel very sort of disturbed by that. Because unfortunately, I think there is one segment of the audience in the class who might think this is what we're here for. To be like bang the table kind of aggressive alpha male businessman. And I just feel like that might work for you and five people. What's the rest of the world? What's their opinion of that?
Sure.
So that's second. And third, I think we talked a lot about it in business school, but I think what we were not encouraged to do is to apply it in practice a lot more. So your thought frameworks and case studies of what works. So it goes back to your success stories. To some extent, here and there, a professor will throw in a case study in around what didn't work. And you have a debate about it. My point is both teach you frameworks of how to see risks and see what works, what doesn't work.
Still at a cognitive level, right?
Why? Now tell me, apply it to everything that you are comfortable with and break it down and show me what can be disrupted. So if my point is, it's not about tell me whether Uber was cool. You take an area, or the professor gives an area and says traffic or cabs or whatever is broken in the city, fix it, come back with an idea. Right? So it used to be projected as business plan competitions, entrepreneurship classes. I think that's bullshit. Everybody should go through it. That's so limiting in thinking of, oh, if I can make money off this, what is the idea?
It's fascinating, actually. It's almost like the difference between reverse engineering what's working in the world versus programming the world for the future, which is a very different mindset, right? And the B-School is often about reverse engineering what's working in the world today, which necessarily does not translate to building the future. Right?
I might be paraphrasing, but there's a very famous quote, right? The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man does not. And the world progresses because of the unreasonable man.
Yep.
So that, again, when you're sitting in business school, why are you educating an entire bunch of 800 people, 500 people to go and play by the playbook and not change it? So this framework for change, I don't think is driven hard enough, deep enough. And I think it should be part of every course, every curriculum. So we say you're doing HR building, then where is the world going? Like, why is a new media outlet today projecting the future of jobs? Why isn't like business school doing it? You're supposed to be the pioneers in this thought leadership. So it's there in theoretical frameworks, but I don't think the students are forced to apply it. So I missed all of that. I just feel like, wow, that's all business school should have been about. These 3-4 things.
And one piece of advice, career or life advice that stuck with you the most?
Advice is, it took a long time, but I think advice has come down to where I'm at in life today, which is the cliched, you know, love what you do and you'd never have to work a day in your life. Once you're sitting in this position, you appreciate the earnings, the income, the learnings from everything you've done, but you wonder, what nonsense, why would I do anything else? And why isn't everyone in that position?
Right.
I don't expect everyone to miraculously, it's luck of the draw. You can find it in your second year. You can find it in your 10th. You can find it in your 15th. But I think if you're not striving for it, you're going to be miserable.
That's an interesting point. Again, that segues to the next question, which is about, one is about attributing it to luck. But is there a way, again, if we sort of pick up the transition from B-School as a moment where you make a choice in direction, and then maybe subsequently how we navigate our ship, is there some headline thought on what one could do to maximize the odds of finding oneself in this position of loving what you do?
I think it's difficult, and how I don't have an easy solution for it. Maybe goes back to one of those things, what they didn't teach you at B-School. And it's a tough one. I mean, B-School is trying to... So I gave a lot of soft stuff. It's not easy to build into curriculum openly, sure. Right? But and curriculum is tough as is. They're trying to teach you every aspect of business that you can possibly cram into 2 years.
Sure.
And if you go into some of the European schools in 1 year.
Yeah.
So where's the time for anything else? But if you're truly going there to sort of change course, try to find your path, trying to see where you want to be in 15, 20 years, shouldn't there be again more application of time and mind to that point? So at one level there is. Within 3 weeks of joining business school, the first pre-placement talks and all of that start, right? So there is that orientation is there, but I think it's very bland.
Hmm.
The company is coming and telling you what it does.
It's a series of sales pitches, right?
By the companies.
Exactly.
Where are the people? Where are the roles? Why aren't these Q&A video says webinars with alums who are actually in the industry? So why am I not being invited by IMB or Wharton to tell them what post 15, 20 years of working, where I'm at and what... This blog post that you're doing is fascinating because I think that's what all
that's
the B-School...
one of the objectives of why I'm doing what I'm doing, right?
Which is amazing that you're doing it, but that's what every B-School kid should be doing it at age 23. So at least that goes back to the very first point you asked me. Why two MBAs and how... It's the path. I'm not saying I'll define the path for you. It's fraught with 8 different roads, right? And some of it is design, some of it is fate, right? So you can't judge that on day one. But at least the end goal becomes somewhat nebulously clear, right? That is shockingly absent in most people's thought process. Because you're either working off a very limited set of data on what the job looks like from the outside and not understanding from the inside. And sometimes you'll talk to your guys who are 2 years out. Because the poor guys are sent to pitch. They say, aap, 2 saal pehle you got hired by out of Wharton or IMB. Go talk to your kids. What the hell do they know, yeah?
Mm.
It's the guy who's actually spent 20 years who
knows. Through that journey, right?
Yeah. Let him speak passionately. I'm not saying you should diss it. Banking is great. For A, B, C, D, not for X, Y, Z.
That's correct.
So A, B, C, D, sit up on a pedestal and tell why banking is great. Mingle with that person over a drink and say, am I this guy? Do I want to be this guy? No? Let me get the hell out of this banking room.
Right.
It's as simple as that if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a lot of choices I made were like that. I just didn't see myself as a consultant.
Hmm.
I didn't see myself as having that discipline, that framework, that... I think most people say I'm a great advisor. I am a consultant in some sense. But not in that frame application of how the output is arguably fee for giving advice.
Right.
Whereas I wanted it to be a principal role.
Understood.
So like my wife jokes now you give other people money to give advice.
That's fair actually. That's a smarter way of deploying your skills. So I think... one thing that entrepreneurs get intellectually, but find it hard to put in practice. Lovely. Karthik, it's been a really energizing, I think, 90 minutes of conversation. This podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals really figuring out what that sweet spot is that you alluded to and really playing the best they can. So in summary, any one or two takeaways for the listeners?
I think people get guided by too many conventional paths. And I think the world's further shifting away from conventional paths. Whether that says jobs are going away or there's a constant learning in the job. All of that is true. It's always been true. I think it's just getting accelerated like crazy. So the soft skills are going to matter as much as the hard skills. And so we touched upon a bunch of them in different contexts. So one is you can't run away from that if you want to be very successful, right? And very satisfied. So a lot of people say, no, I'm not that kind of person. I don't want to do that. I don't think those options exist anymore. And you have to be able to negotiate for yourself ideologically, philosophically, what are absolute cannot do's, right? The half the reason I like venture is I think we just stay out of the gamut of all these murky business practices, etc., which might already be present in a company or in the industry or etc. You're shaping all of that. Okay. So you feel you have a lot more control. It's just not my DNA. So you tell me, I'll give you $1 billion, go run a PE fund, and say, no, thank you, I'm happy where I'm at. So you can play to your potential when I think you know what you know best about yourself, which is why sometimes I'm surprised how every 23-year-old thinks he can be a great entrepreneur or a businessman. You don't know much about yourself. When you adapt yourself to these various situations is when you know what your potential is, what you don't like. Probably a lot of the times, a lot of people really don't ever know. Maybe it's a 20-year journey to get to know what they don't like. It might be too late. But what you don't like informs you. So I think knowing one's potential itself is such a big challenge. Yes. That if you're not open about discovering that, then you're always going to be suboptimal in some sense. Might be happy, but you might not be playing to your potential. That's kind of the philosophical take I have on it.
Hey, fascinating, Karthik. I think the takeaway for me is that the answer is within, and that's a process of journey of discovery that there's no shortcuts there, right?
Absolutely.
Lovely, Karthik. Thank you so much. Really learned a lot and enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com. You can also catch the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and other popular podcast apps. If you found this conversation of value, you might also like to listen into my conversations with Avnish Bajaj and Karthik Hosanagar, where I covered similar topics. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast series. Bye now.